From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Noe Valley, San Francisco.
DuBose Triangle, Lower Haight.
Visitation Valley.
Downtown San Francisco.
Oh, Ingleside SF.
Coming up, Bay Area bike share is a big hit in downtown San Francisco. But what about the rest of the city?
Like, if I wanted to take one of my bikes to, you know, the Bayview or to the Mission or Sunset, I really can't do that.
Expanding bike share. Then we'll talk to documentary filmmaker Frederick Wiseman about his newest project.
I had long wanted to do a movie about a university, and Berkeley is the great public university of the country, if not the world. And they said, okay.
And we prick up our ears to celebrate Audiograph's one-year birthday.
It's really great to go up close to things.
It's a party today on Cross Currents. One thing that's been on Bay Area minds lately is how we get around. We have a newly minted bridge, a fledgling agreement between Muni and tech company shuttles, and yes, even a Google boat. But for some people, the best way to get around still involves two wheels. Yes, bikes. The idea is that short trips, like running quick errands or bridging that last mile gap from BART to where you work, well, they just make more sense on a bike. So the regional Bay Area Quality Management District got together with local transit agencies to create Bay Area Bike Share. It launched about 4 months ago, and now it's time to take stock. So far, people have taken close to 100,000 trips on 700 of the program's signature minty green bikes. Half of those are in San Francisco, while the rest are spread out along Caltrain stops in Redwood City, Palo Alto, Mountain View, and San Jose. It's a pilot program, so far still just on training wheels, so will it really take off? KALW's transportation reporter Isabel Angel has the story.
The success of Bay Area Bike Share depends on one place, downtown San Francisco. Back in August, Bay Area Bike Share made a well-calculated gamble and stuck half the bikes in an area covering downtown, the financial district, and south of Market. Basically, if Bike Share doesn't work there, it won't work in the Bay Area. So I headed to the heart of downtown, the corner of Market and Powell, to see how the program works at street level. And I don't know where the closest dock is, so of course there's an app for that. It's called Cycle Finder here in San Francisco. Okay, it looks like there's one just up the street. So I'm going to head over there. It tells me that there's 7 bikes, so I'm totally fine. And I'll head on over. We'll catch up with me later. Heath Maddox oversees the Bay Area Bike Share for the San Francisco Municipal Transportation Agency. So yeah, he loves it.
Absolutely. It's called a very successful start. Yeah, it's something I've been working on for 3 years now, and it's really gratifying.
You might expect he'd say that. But if you look at the numbers, it's not just talk. Compare it with Washington, D.C.'s Capital Bike Share, which started a few years back. Over the first 2 months, it averaged about 2 rides per bike per day.
Which is a pretty standard benchmark. And in San Francisco, not in the region, but just in the San Francisco service area, we're seeing more like 2.4, 2.5 rides per bike per day, which is fantastic.
To get on a bike, you need to buy a pass, which gives you unlimited rides under half an hour. Some people were upset by the pricing scheme. Any ride longer than 30 minutes will rack up some big fees pretty quickly. But the program has generally avoided the pitfalls of other cities, like software glitches or too many bikes at one station and not enough at another. In fact, most complaints with Bay Area Bike Share focus on one thing. It's not big enough. For more on that, let's get back to me at the bike dock at 5th and Market. One thing about bike share in San Francisco is that there's only 350 bikes, so all of the bikes are concentrated in the downtown area, on Civic Center and south of Market and kind of along the waterfront. So if you want to go to other places in the city, like if I wanted to take one of my bikes to, you know, the Bayview or to the Mission or Sunset, I really can't do that.
I was just looking to see if it was in my neighborhood, and I would definitely use it if it was expanded. My name is Liz, and I'm from San Francisco. I live in the Mission.
Liz Combs doesn't come downtown very often, but she's here now at a bike share dock on Market near the Montgomery BART station.
I might consider trying it at least for a day or two.
A day pass is $9. 3 days costs $22. So far, these short-term versions have proven a lot more popular than the annual passes, which cost almost $90. I'm actually an annual member, so I can use the bikes anytime. Back at the dock, it's pretty easy for me to check out a bike. So I can just stick my little key thing into the slot and open it up. If you're not, then you go to the kiosk and you put in your credit card and you, they basically gives you a code and then you type in the code to your bike share. Here we go. So I'm going to stick my key slot in. Interesting. I want to go to Civic Center. I want to bike down to City Hall, drive straight down Market. Luckily, there's a nice bike lane here. Now, one thing is, I am not a usual bike rider, so I don't have a helmet, which is, I realize, not good. But I don't have one, and bike shares don't come with helmets, so I'm going to be stuck without one, unfortunately. But the data does show that I will actually be, as a bike share rider, I will be a more cautious biker than, you know, the normal cyclist who rides their bike all the time in the city. So I'll be a little bit more cautious and actually less likely to get into an accident. So I guess I have that going for me. While I bike towards City Hall, it might be a good time to branch out a bit. The Bay Area isn't the only place that got a brand new bike share last summer. New York City launched City Bike in June, a couple months before the Bay Area bike share. Kate Hines covers transportation for WNYC, the city's biggest public radio station.
I think right now it's fair to say that New York City's bike share program is a huge success in terms of raw numbers.
The city's Department of Transportation projected about 60,000 members in the program's first year.
And right now, 5 months into the program, we're at over 93,000 annual members.
In comparison, Bay Area Bike Share has netted just over 3,000 annual members so far. But New York City had a couple of things going for it to pump up its numbers. First, it started with almost 10 times as many bikes. And second, it snagged a sponsor, Citibank. That's where Citibike gets its name. The financial giant paid about $40 million for that privilege. Hines says Citibike did get a lot of backlash about the sponsorship.
There was a huge outcry about it, especially since, of course, this is the city that launched Occupy Wall Street. There were some system defacings happening in which people put up stickers that said "Shitty Bike" instead of Citibike. So there's been some backlash, but it hasn't been huge.
But
overall, this has been a big win for Citibank, which got, I think, a pretty big bang for its buck.
Okay, so I made it to City Hall with no issues. One time a car did kind of fly by me in the bike lane, but I got out of the way and it was fine. Okay, so I'm bringing it back, and I know from experience you really have to like jam these guys back into the docks. And the light's green. There's a little light on the dock that shows me that I have indeed returned it, and I'm under the 30 minutes, so everything's all good. Bay Area Bike Share made it easy for me to get from the Powell BART station to City Hall, but it doesn't go much further than that. So in San Francisco, the big question is, where will it go next? The city is slated to get 150 more bikes next year. The SFMTA's Heath Maddox says they'll go in the Upper Market and Mission districts.
They are just as suitable as the initial area, no doubt about it. We were hearing from people that anecdotally that they would like it if it went to areas more where they lived and played and less where they worked.
Plus, the Upper Market and Mission connect to the existing area. But what about beyond that?
If I had, you know, $20 to $30 million, then I would say that we could roll them out sort of on a blanket basis in the northeast quadrant of the city, and it would work very well.
That would include places like the Marina, Pacific Heights, and Nob Hill, where just over 40% of San Franciscans live. Maddox says it could go even further than that. The city could sustain up to 3,000 bikes, and the entire region about 10,000. But for that to happen, the Bay Area might need its own corporate sponsor. Google Bikes, anyone? Officials are looking into it. For Cross Currents, I'm Isabel Angel.
So do you want to see bike sharing reach your neighborhood? Find a link to SF Bike Share's crowdsourcing website at kalw.org. Click on Cross Currents. You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba.
Chinatown, my Chinatown, where will I die?
That's the opening to Frederick Wiseman's first and most famous documentary movie, Titicut Follies. The controversial 1967 film details the degrading treatment of patients at a Massachusetts hospital for the criminally insane. In the film's opening scene, inmates are on a stage, mechanically performing in a hospital talent show. That's why, soon after its release, a Massachusetts judge banned it, citing patient privacy concerns. Eventually, though, the ban on Titicut Follies was lifted in 1991. In those 24 years since it was released, Wiseman applied his verite approach to a series of institutions, including a high school, a prison, a meatpacking plant, and a ballet company. And he became arguably the most influential documentary filmmaker of his generation. Most recently, the now 83-year-old filmmaker trained his eye on UC Berkeley. Filmed during the fall 2010 semester, his film At Berkeley takes us into the classrooms, the research labs, administrative meetings, stadiums, and protests at a university in the middle of a severe financial crisis. I recently talked with Wiseman and started out by asking him why he's so fascinated by making movies about big institutions.
It's an opportunity to observe a large number of people working together by certain rules and to see what the relationship is between the rules and their behavior. It's an opportunity to have a look at a vast array of human behavior, and it's an opportunity to have a look at contemporary American life through institutions that are important for the functioning of a democratic society and which exists in most communities. For example, there are prisons for the criminally insane and prisons and police departments and hospitals and high schools everywhere.
At Berkeley is the 38th film in the series about contemporary institutions. You say you spent 12 weeks there and shot 250 hours of material, and it was just you and two other people. Give us insight on how that happens. 250 hours of material sounds like a whole lot to my, you know, radio producer ears.
Well, it is, but you need to have a lot of material in order to make a film, because I don't go into the film with a thesis or a point of view. During the shooting, all that's done is collecting sequences that I might use. And I like to go into a shoot with an open mind and without a preconceived point of view toward the material.
So let's hear a clip from At Berkeley. Here, students are discussing their motivation to go to the school.
They asked students in the 60s and they asked students now why you went to school. And people in the 60s went, it's because I want to learn more about life. And people want to go to school now because they want to make a lot of money. It's this notion of, are we going to school to get a job? Or are we going to school to fully understand how wonderful life is and all of its many things? I mean, how many students do you know actually, rather than playing video games, are reading, you know, the great thinkers of the past?
That's a clip from At Berkeley by Fred Wiseman, a new documentary film based in UC Berkeley. Wiseman joins me now. So what we're used to in terms of documentaries is narration and talking heads, and you use neither. So why is that, and what do you think it does?
Well, I mean, you can make very good films with narration and talking heads. I choose a style where I'm just following people and none of the events are staged. And I like that better because I think it gives the viewer a sense of immediacy and participation and a sense of being there when the technique works. Narration is an intrusion, really, and the narrator usually does the thinking for the viewer, whereas in my films, I hope I provide the viewer with enough information so they can figure out for themselves what's going on and have a greater sense of being closer to the events that they're watching and hearing and therefore participating in them and making up their own minds about what it is they're seeing and hearing rather than being told what to think.
So let's hear another clip from the film At Berkeley. Then-Chancellor Robert Bourgeonneau discusses financial challenges.
A really important part of our challenges as less and less of our funds come from the state government. How do we, first of all, maintain our preeminence? But secondly, how do we guarantee our public character? Because we must not compromise on that. As I've said often, the country has many great private universities, Stanford, Harvard, et cetera, and it doesn't need another one. It needs great public universities. And how are we going to do that in an environment where the state is progressively disinvesting? And of course, it's not unique to California.
That's former UC Berkeley Chancellor Robert Bourgeonneau. And that clip is from At Berkeley, a new documentary film by Fred Wiseman. The film is based inside UC Berkeley. So in the midst of California's education budget crisis, it's an especially interesting time to be visiting Berkeley. So what did you find in terms of, it's not Berkeley at any given time, it's Berkeley at a time of crisis?
Well, some of the film deals with the financial crisis. Much of the film doesn't. The classroom scenes, the sports scenes, the a cappella groups, etc., have nothing to do with the crisis, except implicitly in the sense that the excellence of the teaching and the quality of the research would over time certainly be affected by the budget crisis, unless it was resolved or unless the university found other ways of maintaining its standards and integrity. And one of the things you see in the film, you see the administration, the chancellor, the provost, and the other members of the administration working very hard to maintain the high standards of the university and succeeding.
It seems like there's very little social life depicted in the film in terms of drinking or partying. So is that a decision that you made to kind of reflect the academic side?
I really was making the film about the, I hate to use the word formal, but the formal aspects of university life. There are probably, 20,000 things that aren't in the film. And the film already is 4 hours long.
And how long did it take you to edit that?
About 14 months.
But for you, that's what it takes.
That's what it takes, yeah. I mean, editing a movie like At Berkeley is a manic depressive special. Some days you think the material's great. Some days you think it's the worst thing you've ever seen. And it's neither.
Why are you still making films? And do you think you'll ever stop?
You know, it beats working for a living. And the fun for me, of making documentary movies is that I have a new subject to think about every year. And I mean, the basic question I'm constantly asking myself is why? What's going on in the sequence? Why is it going on? Why does somebody ask for a cigarette? Why do they use the language they do? Why this word rather than that word? What's the implication of a change in tone of voice or the request for a cigarette? Or a break, and it requires an effort at an intense analysis of human behavior, which has nothing to do with filmmaking technique, but to which you're applying filmmaking technique in order to construct the movie.
Any tips for up and coming documentary filmmakers?
Marry somebody rich.
Many thanks to KALW's David Boyer for facilitating that interview. You can see Frederick Wiseman's latest documentary, At Berkeley, this coming Monday, January 13th, on PBS. Details are at KALW.org. Click on Cross Currents. You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. And now it's time for Audiograph. And today is a special day. It's the one-year anniversary of our sonic treasure hunt. Happy birthday, Audiograph! All year
year long on KALW, we've been playing you sounds we've recorded all over the Bay Area, and you've been a big part of what we've discovered. We've asked you to listen for what it sounds like where you are, what you hear all the time, what it means to you, and what it tells you about where you live. Here are some of your answers.
When we moved here, we moved from Berkeley, and the one thing that we remember from the difference the first night were all the crickets. It's very something that we associate with Napa, and it wasn't in the area of Berkeley that we were living in. It was mostly sirens, so it was a welcome change.
The males sound kind of like a lion. The babies sound kind of like monkeys, and the females kind of sound like they're barking like a dog.
You can imagine scratchy 78 in these little shacks by the sea here, middle of San Pablo Bay, and drunken waiters from like the downtown grills in San Francisco have come up to rent skiffs. This is the soundtrack here.
It was alive. There was so much going on all of the time. Well, it was a hum of a place, and you walk in here, it was humming.
It's really great to go up close to things.
I would never want to not listen to this. After listening like this, I want to always listen like this.
We love listening like this, too. Those were the sounds of Napa, Año Nuevo, China Camp, radio station KPH, and Oakland's Lake Merritt. And we have lots of great sounds in store for you in 2014. Our contest starts up again next week. Here's a sneak peek. So, do you know what that is and where we recorded it? Call us and let us know. The number is 415-264-7106. That's 415-264-7106. We'll have the story behind the sound next Thursday here on Cross Currents, so be sure to tune in. And if you want to play the audiograph game with us in person, we'll be performing at Oakland Nights Live on Saturday night. To find out more, go to KALW.org.
I'm writing a song all about you. A true song as real as my tears. But you've no need to fear it, 'cause no one will hear it. Sad songs and waltzes aren't selling this year.
And that wraps up today's edition of Cross Currents. The team includes Leela Day, Audrey Dilling, Laura Flynn, Nina Gensler-Debs, Linda Jew, Ashley Ann Krigbaum, Ryan Miller, Seth Samuel, and Todd Whitney. Today's show was produced by Julie Kane and engineered by Chris Hoff. Casey Miner is our senior editor. Martina Castro is our senior producer. Our executive editor is Ben Trefney. Holly Kernan is our news director. And thanks to you, we are listener-supported radio.
It's a perfect day, and I feel a perfect way.
This is San Francisco native Maya Castleman. Trained in musical theater and jazz, she's more recently been influenced by collaborations with hip-hop producers and rappers. Maya Castleman has an album release concert on Saturday night at 50 Mason Social House in San Francisco. Music starts at 7 o'clock. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba.